talk today about the status of and the expectations for gravitational wave observation. And I'm actually going to focus specifically on ground-based laser interferometers, and even more specifically on ones that are currently either being built or planned for funding. So nothing too far. Okay, so like I said, so this talk is about the status and prospects for ground-based gravitational wave astronomy. The planned advanced detectors I will talk about are things that actually have at least partial funding. Most of them are fully funded, ready to go. I'm going to basically have a complete emphasis on the observation of compact binary systems. I'm not going to talk about some of the other very exciting sources, possible sources of gravitational radiation, but I'm going to focus on this. The reason is it's something I work on personally, so I know the most about it. But it's also probably the most realistic candidate for first detections. And so I think it's the thing that we should spend more time on. So this talk is not about other gravitational wave experiments, such as pulsar timing, or the space-based detectors that are planned, or any theoretical advanced detectors, like I said. Those are all great things, but not planned. Okay, so I've broken this up into sort of a few pieces here. So I'm going to first of all give a description of the past and present detectors. I'm going to talk about reaching initial design sensitivity in 2005 and going beyond it just in the past few years. I'm then going to talk about what searches for compact binaries have accomplished so far. Before I get into that, I'll actually describe what sort of we expected to see. After that, I'm going to go on talking about advanced detectors. And I'm going to focus on the advanced LIGO and Virgo detectors, LCGT, and possibly this other project that may exist in Australia. And then in part four, I'm going to talk about searches for compact binaries in the advanced detector era, basically what kind of rates we would expect, some things we're going to be trying to do. And then in the last bit, I'm going to talk about what happens between now and then. So we call this the Dark Age. For those of you who don't know this, the LIGO detector shut down this past fall, so we are waiting for the new ones to cycle. So I'm going to talk about what we're doing. Okay, first I have some news. This is cool, you get to see all of my slides in advance. So nothing will be a surprise.
Yeah.
Anyway, so first I'm going to say we have some news. The Kirkwood Institute and CETA are actually the first institutions in Canada to join the LSC. When I was transitioning to be a postdoc here, Kip Cannon and I in the back, a postdoc at CETA, we petitioned the LSC to basically start a new group. We were both at LSC institutions previous to that. Anyway, so we were accepted and we're thankful for it. And so we hope that this is just the beginning of some great stuff to happen here in the gravitational wave.
Chad, do you want to say what it means to be a member of the LSC? What do you have access to?
We basically have access to the data, which is of course the important thing. For those of you who don't know, LIGO data is proprietary, at least for the time being. The NSF is, of course, wanting that to change on some time scale, and I think we'll be in fact set on those panels. So that will happen at some point. There will probably always be some proprietary period, so being in the LSC basically gives you the first access to data. It's an important thing. Right now, the access is just restricted to Kip and I, but the group can grow as the need is there. So basically, anyone interested in this sort of thing should talk to us. Okay. So I'm going to talk about past/present detectors, because like I said, fortunately, I think, the current LIGO detectors are now past. We moved on to a different era. So the little animation at the top, for those of you who don't know, the idea is gravitational waves stretch and squeeze space-time. Something passing over with the correct polarization and orientation relative to one of the detectors will basically change the lengths and two arms of a microcentimeter. And we can hopefully measure that change. And So it's been a long agenda to basically meet a design sensitivity that was put into place years and years and years ago. And LIGO actually reached their initial design sensitivity setting in 2005. Interferometers put at two sites. And one of them is in Hanford, Washington, and the other is in Livingston, Louisiana. The Hanford site has a 4-kilometer interferometer, and in the same vacuum, a 2-kilometer interferometer as well. So halfway down, there are actually mirrors for a different detector. Livingston just has the single 4-kilometer detector. Some people ask me why these sites were chosen. There are lots of reasons. First of all, you need a lot of land, so someone has to give you that land. But the remoteness of these sites has to do a lot with basically trying to find some place that is going to have as little man-made noise as possible. And also, you know, you take into consideration the seismic activity and whatnot in your instances. I won't comment on how successful those choices were, but we got the instruments working, and that's what matters. Okay, so anyway, so this is an important thing to sort of think about going into this. The first science one that LIGO did took place in 2002. And when we started, this is actually the amplitude spectral density. So this is strain per square root hertz versus frequency. I'm sorry, slide that off. Versus frequency on this axis. So you can see that we're talking about really small numbers, measuring strains on the order of 10 to the minus 22. When we first started in S1, the noise curve was still kind of, you know, an impressive feat at the time, but it took from 2002, rather, to 2007, this was late in S5, to knock essentially two orders of magnitude off of this. So it's a tremendous progress in commissioning. And the key thing here is this black line, which is actually the design sensitivity. So this is what the engineers and the scientists said decades ago could be done, and it's actually pretty well spot on. So it's quite an impressive accomplishment. And it gives us a lot of hope going into the future in the advanced detector era that people know what they're doing. So we feel pretty confident. I should also mention Virgo. I don't have a photo here. Virgo is a detector in near Pisa, Italy, that is a 3-kilometer detector. Its frequency response is slightly different. I think we'll see a plot a bit later, but it joined with LIGO, so we actually worked out a joint agreement to analyze data cooperatively. And in 2007, we started analyzing data together. Their sensitivity was quite a bit lower, but they've since improved, and I can talk a little bit about that. Okay, so after 2007, there was a dark period, actually. So we shut down in 2007, and there was about 2 years, which is a non-trivial amount of time, where a lot of work was done to commission the detectors. Now, this had been sort of in the works for a while, basically sort of an intermediate stage detector, where some of the advanced LIGO systems would be put in place. It would improve the sensitivity of the current detector, and it would also test some technologies that kind of needed to be in addition, not only did we get to test those things, but we were targeting a factor of 2 improvement in sensitivity, so a factor of 2 in range, if you like. So it wasn't shabby. In the end, we didn't quite reach that until nearly the end of the run, but by the end of the run, they basically had gotten nearly the factor of 2 that they had wanted. So everything seemed to be as they had expected. I should mention that LIGO's H2 detector was actually not operated, and instead Virgo came online, and it actually was a very capable detector. They did some commissioning and other things, but it was actually fairly sensitive. This run only lasted a little over a year. We could have kept taking data. We didn't, because we did not want to push back the advanced LIGO timeline. So essentially, we know that when advanced LIGO was built, the odds of detecting something will be so much higher that it's not worth actually postponing that to look at the same now. So in order to get things done in a timely fashion, So this is a preliminary spectrum. I had to dig to make sure this was even public, but it is. So I think this is the factor of two that was promised, essentially. So this dashed line now is the initial LIGO noise curve, and these red and blue lines are the two LIGO temperatures. So you can see, at least for higher frequencies, there's actually even better than a factor of two. Not so good at low frequencies, but it's still quite the accomplishment. This, by the way, is the promised Virgo spectrum. Versus Virgo's design here. So they didn't quite end up doing as well as they would have liked, but they were still, it was still a great observatory.
What were the major changes that might have enhanced LIGO?
So, continued work on seismic isolation. Some of that work had already been started in Livingston. It turns out, I made a comment at the beginning about these research sites, right? So it turns out Livingston ended up having a lot more noise. The same thing ended up having a lot more noise than the original surveys suggested. So actually, very early on, a lot of advanced LIGO technology was actually applied to Livingston way back in the 3 years. And this is basically the idea of active seismic isolation, so actively correcting for ground motion. So that was done, I think, then at both sites in enhanced LIGO. The other thing was to change the readout scheme. The photodiodes, it's kind of a complicated story, but it was an important change for advanced LIGO. They changed how to actually read the differential out.
Is Virgo shutting down and going into some kind of advanced phase?
Yes, good question. They're not shut down yet, to my knowledge, though. They're going to run for a little while longer. Kind of bring this up. So Virgo will run for a little longer, then they will also be shutting down to do basically an advanced phase. Hopefully there will also be GEO running during sort of the dark period. I think the community in general is concerned that we don't want to miss an opportunistic, like a galactic supernova or something, right? So we want to have at least some detector operating at all times. That's what we get goal. We'll see if it works out. Of course, when you're down to one detector, that detector won't run all the time, so you still have a chance that it does. Just that well. Okay. All right, so I'm going to talk a little bit about basically past and ongoing searches for compact binary for all sorts. So the idea is, this is something that we know is a real thing. So there are observations of double pulsar, basically neutron star systems, double neutron star systems, that have orbital decays completely consistent with general relativity. So we know they're giving off gravitational radiation. They are not, however, giving off gravitational radiation at a frequency that LIGO can detect. But we sort of infer that similar systems are further along in their evolution. So how this works is a compact binary will emit energy from gravitational radiation, and the orbit will shrink. And when that happens, they get closer together, and actually they emit even more gravitational radiation, so the orbit shrinks more. And in the last few minutes, actually, of compact objects like neutron stars or black holes with roughly solar masses, you actually observe this chirp waveform, where you have this increasing amplitude and increasing frequency gravitational wave strain. And this is nice. This waveform actually depends, you know, on the masses and potentially the spins of the objects and everything. But this is a very, very well modeled process. And because of that, we can actually do a very deep search in the data by essentially correlating the data with exactly what we expect these to be. So we really are able to make the best use of our data. So that's one of the reasons why we think this is a potentially the first sort of detection. Okay, so the big question in aftermath, what did we expect to see? Well, the rates for how often we would expect to observe these binary systems merging in the universe to where they're actually, you know, in the last few minutes of their evolution, and just happen to be doing that right now. Those sort of rates have been researched for years. There is a huge body of literature on it. And unfortunately, the rates are somewhat uncertain. However, people are starting to get sort of some rough agreement on what the general intervals for the rates for these things are. If you consider neutron star binaries, how often you would expect that merger to happen in a radius that's sufficient for LIGO to detect it, the current LIGO detectors, the ones that would shut down. You only expect that to happen, the most likely estimate's probably about once every 50 years. For neutron star black holes, it's a little bit worse, and black holes, a little bit worse yet. The optimistic estimates, if you check, could actually put things at almost one per year. So if you observe a couple of years and you were optimistic, it's possible that initial LIGO could have seen them. And I should say up front, actually, we're not done analyzing the data. So even though the detectors are shut down, we actually have some data that we're not finished. So there still could be a serendipitous detection. But realistically, it was never that promising. But we'll see. Okay. So when we actually did the searches for these things, the waveforms that we would see in the data depend on the masses of the components. They also depend on spin and other things, but for the most part, we think that at least getting the phasing correct based on just the component masses is typically adequate for detection. Sometimes that's not true. Previously, we sort of had issues with understanding this particular region of the mass space. So above three solar masses, what happens is the actual merger of the, actually a bit higher than three solar masses, I should say, it's several tens of solar masses. The issue is that the merger, so not just the nice gradual in spiral that's producing that shift waveform, but at some point there are no more stable circular orbits and things plunges together and produces the signal. Now that can actually be a fairly substantial signal. For neutron stars, that particular process happens basically pretty high in the detector spectrum. And so it's actually not that visible to us. But for heavier systems, it is. And so it was actually very difficult to know what to expect in this higher mass region. Unless you get to a sufficiently high mass where the only thing you were sensitive to was the final black hole that existed in everything you saw. So basically, which you could then just get from blurry vision theory. So that was actually well modeled, but there was this region here that was not. Turns out, I'm going to mention this in some next slides, that we actually had some great work done from the numeric relativity community in the last 5 years also. It's enabled us to do a much, much, much better job of analyzing systems in this particular area. And I'm going to expand on that specifically today because there are actually some new results. So we changed our perspective. Now we actually feel like we have a pretty good understanding. So in S5, we actually were able to feel pretty confident even about some of the wings here and the previous things, looking for more asymmetric systems. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about the heavier systems. Oh, actually, but first, I should say that we didn't see much so far. We did, however, constrain some of the rates. And one of the things that turned out to be more interesting than I maybe initially thought it would be, but it's actually turned out to be a positive response, I think, from the astronomy community. There was one of these sort of interesting serendipitous things that happened during S5. And there was a GRB that had an overlapping air box with Andromeda Galaxy. Now, one of the possible models for GRBs is actually the merger of neutron stars, or neutron stars and black holes. So if the source of it was in fact Andromeda, we would have had no trouble seeing it, essentially. Andromeda is only, it's less than a megaparsec away. And our sensitivity was sufficient that there should have been a very loud signal if in fact it was a compact binary merger of Andromeda. And we didn't see anything. So we were able to basically exclude that as the model. There's some distance exclusion. Basically, the other way we put it was to exclude the distance at 90% at which a compact binary merger would have been invisible. So it's actually quite a bit above the Andromeda line, which is I should say we didn't rule out any other possible models, like gamma ray repeater models that could emit gravitational radiation, but we wouldn't have been sensitive enough to them. So the other things that we've learned so far, we've learned actually very valuable lessons about instrumental noise, and basically about how we plan to get the significance for a particular event when it occurs. And this is going to be, this is actually a critical lesson. It turns out initial LIGO data was actually pretty bad. It was very non-stationary, full of glitches, all sorts of troubles. And it took actually the data analysts several years to get a handle on how to make sense of it. And this is an extremely valuable lesson because we sort of expect now advanced detectors to be the same way. And we know what we're getting into. We also started to forge some really excellent collaborations with various other astronomical experiments, optical, X-ray, all sorts of things. And we're actually sending out events with sky positions, KS6. And this is what I had started to mention earlier. We significantly improved our modeling of compact planet coalescence thanks to numerical relativity. So at least in a particular mass range for binary black hole systems, we were able to do a much better job. And I'm actually going to go into a little bit of detail about that because this is stuff that Kip and I have actually been working on quite a bit in the last few years, and the results are brand new. The paper is going to be in the archive in hopefully a week. Hopefully less. Okay, so the idea is that that only a small fraction of systems, of stars rather, are actually massive enough to form compact objects at all. And the number of stars that are massive enough to form black holes of any particular size, I thought to actually be pretty small. But there have been actually some pretty interesting systems observed recently, specifically this one, IC10X1, which is known to have a very high mass black hole, somewhere in the range 24 to 31 solar masses, with a companion star that's actually also very massive. And whenever this binary evolves a bit more, and its companion star dies and collapses, it could very well form a black hole itself. Assuming that the binary survives that and doesn't, actually end up getting unbound enough that it won't merge in the age of the universe, assuming that doesn't happen, and this could actually be in the future, when some advanced human race is doing the same thing we are, this could actually be a great source. If you believe this is going to be a great source in 100 million years or something, then maybe there's reason to believe that such a binary already exists now. And so things like this have actually caused a bit of a stir in people reconsidering the possibility that binaries with tens of solar masses, black hole binaries with tens of solar masses, might actually exist, might be useful sources for LIGO. There's an old picture that if any of you have seen old LIGO talks, you've seen before. It's this one. And it's credited to Kip Thorne. Previously I mentioned that this inspiral phase is well modeled, and we understand sort of this chirp waveform that one gets as the binary orbits are shrinking and gravitational radiation is given off. But this phase, whenever the binary gets sufficiently close, there is this merger epoch that previously there was no real way of solving. Numerical relativity was always thought to be the answer for this, and in fact it is the answer for this. But it's only been until recently that that's actually possible. Or at least that this is sort of like becoming a standard thing one can do. And like I said before, the ring down phase is also known from perturbation theory. For black holes with high enough masses, 25 to 100 or so, it turns out this merger part, like I described previously, is actually directly in the most sensitive region of the LIGO detectors, which means you really need to know the details of this whole transition pretty well if you want to extract the best signal to noise ratio, which in this game, let's face it, we have to. So this is critical because if we didn't have this description, these are challenging sources. And as I said before, numerical relativity has come to the rescue. with some help of some very clever people who have essentially taken numerical activity results and combined them with post-Newtonian results and actually developed all sorts of models that allow us to essentially get the full in-spiral merger and ring-down waveform for a large class of systems. Now that we have this, we can actually make direct use of these insertions. So we can filter our data against this. We can use these for understanding our efficiencies, et cetera. This particular model, I think, is actually an EOV model. So they've actually tuned an effective one-body model to numerical relativity and stitched on. Is there a question? Yeah, I think you're right, actually. This might, maybe it's a phenomenon, I agree.
I think it's a cheat at all.
Yeah, I think you're right, sorry. I didn't remember which one I grabbed. I think I have both down there. So. Okay. So, we did this search. It was a long, so it seems like a kind of a small change to make, to swap out these waveforms, but it took us a while. We started in earnest, I guess, maybe in 2008. So we were looking at actually S5 data. We didn't detect anything. But we have constrained some rates. So we're able to basically, you can sort of imagine just dimensional analysis. If you want to constrain a rate, for example, in a number of mergers per year per megaparsec cubed, then you expect this sort of to be inversely proportional to the volume of space that you're able to see with the detector and the time. With some factor that's going to depend on the statistics of how you arrive at this number, but it's something worth thinking. We have been looking for these systems in the past, but we've never really been able to, but we've always had sort of a gap where we haven't felt comfortable to discuss that sort of above maybe 30 solar masses, but not quite as high as ring downs. We've done several limits that have actually improved over the years, going from S4 to S5. Just to give you a flavor for what the optimistic rate prediction was, it's about 0.3 events per megaparsec cubed per million years. Using the new waveform models and analyzing the S5 data, we were actually able to get these numbers out. And so this is actually the new results. Like I said, we've actually did present these at WPA, which is a conference in Milwaukee a few weeks ago, but the paper should be in the archives soon. You can see we were able to actually put rate numbers in units of mergers per megaparsec cubed per million years for a large portion of the mass space between about 25 total mass and 100 total mass. There was some issues with sort of believing that the waveforms in the sort of asymmetric regions were same. Numerical relativity has only really, I think we have mass ratios, I guess one group is on 1 to 100, but only a few orbits. But for the most part, it's very, very few orbits, maybe 10 to 1 or something like this. So we weren't prepared to really say what astrophysical limits in this region, but we did produce range numbers, essentially effective ranges that we could observe some of these systems. And you can see that actually along the diagonal, we have quite a nice range of these systems at several hundred megaparsecs, even in initial LIGO. So it's an object.
Sorry, is this a
90%?
Yes,
thank you. Yes.
All of that assumes non-spinning black holes.
Indeed, yes, thank you. That's
so are you going to comment on spin and whether you would have seen spinning black holes in those types of machines?
I can comment a little bit on that. So unfortunately, people are starting to develop pretty sophisticated models for generic spins. There aren't enough numerical relativity simulations to spin, unfortunately, right? If we want to fund a huge effort, that could happen. But there are some people who are doing some pretty clever modeling of these things with the help of numerical relativity, and so I think those are coming online now, but they weren't ready for the search. The one thing that was ready, kind of, for the search were the spin-aligned models. So this is the case where the black hole spin is either aligned or anti-aligned with the Rolle increment, or one, which is a probably reasonable case, if one might imagine, for actually isolated binary star position. We tested those against the scoping procedure, and it worked fine. But we don't have an answer for our participants. So our detection efficiency essentially didn't go down very much. We feel like those are pretty stable. Okay. I want to talk a little bit now about some planned events detectors. This is the global network of laser interferometer gravitational detectors. Currently, there are sites already in operation that I've described for LIGO. There's a smaller detector in Germany called GEO, which is, I think, only 600 meters. It has still has quite excellent high frequency sensitivity, and they actually pioneer some pretty cool techniques in squeezing and things like this. The other detector, Virgo, in Pisa, Italy, is still running, and will actually undergo also an advanced detector phase. The kind of exciting one is LCET, which is a cryogenic gravitational wave telescope planned for construction, hopefully by the end of this decade. It has been in the works for a long time. It was just recently funded. And so it's a pretty cool thing to have this. Know this is probably going to come online within the next 10 years or so. There's another thing that's quite speculative, which is this LIGO Australia. So for those of you who don't know, LIGO has made the commitment to ship some of its hardware, which normally would be installed as the second detector in Hanford, to Australia, and set up a detector there, which provides a nice long baseline and so nice sky coverage. If Australia can provide the facilities and operation budget, so this is something we won't know for sure will happen for another year or so. Actually, less than that. I think it's October this year, right? 2011. Which is sort of the cutoff date to know whether or not this is going to work. But it's an exciting thing to watch out for.
I was tuned out. When did the LCGT get funded?
Quite recently.
Probably November last year.
Of November. What's the time schedule?
So, I'm not sure they have a fine, maybe you know better, I'm not sure they have a completely reversed plan for the time scale.
Part of the reason they got the funding is they promised that they could get LIGO to the punch. And realistically, that is likely not going to happen, but they got $150 million for the site. It's going to be in the Kamioka mine. And $150 million is not nearly enough, but we heard 3 weeks ago that now they have some extra money for digging the tunnels.
And how large is their team?
It's small compared to the LIGO team.
Yeah.
Quite a bit smaller.
Are they accreting a lot of particle physicists into location?
I don't know actually. So the TAMA detector's actually been around for a while, and I don't know how much interaction between I don't actually know much about that.
But is it going to be much superior? I mean, much superior to let's say Virgo and GEO? I don't know what GEO status is.
So I think the answer is probably no. So there are a few innovations here. So it's a 3 kilometer detector, which is similar to Virgo. The novel thing that they're going to be doing is cryogenic cooling of the test masses, which is great for reducing thermal noise.
What temperature may it cool?
20 Kelvin.
But they're also underground, which is good for seismic noise.
Yes, thank you. I was getting that. So they'll be underground, so the low frequency noise.
But it's a shaky place, isn't it, Japan?
That's true.
So if Australia goes through, will they be ready when Advanced LIGO is, or do they have to go through some initial testing?
Yeah, unfortunately, probably not. So I'm going to get to the Advanced LIGO timeline here in a second. I don't think anyone has put firm numbers on Australia because we first of all don't know. But it seems highly unlikely that they would be ready on the same time scale as Advanced LIGO. Now, when it happens, if the team can get in there
and build everything, the installation of the hardware should be virtually identical to what had happened in Advanced LIGO. I mean, that's basically the plan. It's a literally the Advanced LIGO hardware. Assuming the facility is roughly compatible, commissioners will have already gone through the process twice by the time they get to it, so it should help. But it's still very strange. Okay, so the advanced network, I'm trying to cover everything quickly here. The advanced network is going to be far more sensitive. We're going to have, hopefully, a factor of 10 in range, roughly, to neutron stars, for example. That corresponds to 1,000 in event rate, if you assume it's sort of distributed uniformly in space or galaxies. We'll have better coverage, because we hope to have more detectors in the far future, LCGT, we'll just be on more oxygen. And we'll have a longer baseline, which is important if we do want to try to do any sort of sky localization. This is some rough timescales for when we get things. So we expect Advanced LIGO to actually have data by 2013. Now, it's not going to be high-quality data, but I'm going to show the timeline next. We will have locking interferometers by then, and the project should be more or less complete by 2013 total. Advanced Virgo, I think they're saying things like 2015 when I check what's public. LIGO Australia, to answer your question, it's as soon as possible. LCGT, later this century. The Advanced LIGO timeline is a bit staggered. They're going to do the L1 installation first. The important part is to note that it will actually be installed by 2015 of July, so it's not very long at all. And we'll have data at that point. The other detectors, I think, are going to be delayed a bit. They're actually doing something pretty cool with H1 to do a squeezing test right now. But anyway, these other interferometers will come online within 6 months of a year afterwards. I'm actually going to skip the next slide. Go to this. Okay, so the future for searches for compact binaries. So we saw what we kind of expected in initial LIGO. The question is, what do we expect now when these come online? So the important thing is that I mentioned already, we actually expect the number of sources to go up volumetrically. So we hope to have another 1,000, factor of 1,000 in our event rate. This is a common picture people have here with the initial LIGO range versus the advanced LIGO range. The factor of 10 allows you a factor of 1,000 in space. What that means is we can realistically expect rates. So this is the same table I showed you before, but I previously cut it off. The suspense. You can have, I can tell you're all. Anyway.
I was awake.
Yeah. So we can reasonably expect, actually, for neutron star mergers alone in advanced LIGO, we meet our design goals, 40 events per year. Now, these numbers are pretty large, but things have converged pretty well over the past years. The gain is a lot worse than it is now. Other interesting sources involving black holes could contribute almost as much. It's worth mentioning, just as a passing point, that's above some particular detection threshold. If you assume things are sort of distributed uniformly in space, the signal to noise ratios you might expect will sort of, by definition, be bunched to being pretty low. So if we were going to detect 37 sources, you'd expect 32 above SNR8, but only 4 above SNR16, and only 1 maybe above SNR25. So we won't be doing a lot of parameter estimation and things like that, but we will have very solid detections. Do you think SNR8 is sufficient for a very solid detection?
What are the maximum ones you in the last comment?
That's a good question. I think these come from arguments like based on the number of supernova and all of them turned into binaries. It's pretty I think it's a very, very, very maxim. So I'd have to remind myself of what that column means. You can almost interpret this as a 95% interval. It's not quite rigorous, but you kind of think this is about the mean and this is a 95% interval.
But the point is, even at the absolute minimum of pessimism, if some of these resources are corresponding to the
previous. Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. So even in the very pessimist perspective, We've been there for a year, we should succeed. Okay, so I should say it's not actually likely that Advanced LIGO will turn on with the full sensitivity. And so I, you know, people have been hesitant to comment on this, right? It's going to take time to commission the detectors. We saw how long it took for the first time, but people feel a lot better about it now they've had practice, right? So if we return on and sort of somewhat quickly be able to get within a factor of two, then you might expect knocking this number down by a factor of eight. So 40 events might get down to five. That's still pretty great. And even though these events will be based on my previous argument with Dalian threshold, if we work hard enough, we can do quite a bit with this. I think five SNR of eight events will be quite convincing. So there could really be pretty early discoveries if when the detector comes on, we're able to quickly get it to the best effect. Yes, but I think it's okay. So, what are we doing with the dark ages? Well, I superimposed a nice bottle of Waterloo Dark like that. the point I really want to make first and foremost in my remaining 2 minutes, 5 minutes now, you must have been holding up for a while. In my remaining couple of minutes, the point I really want to make is the Dark Ages won't be that long. In two and a half years, we'll actually get some data. Now, it's not going to be high quality data, but we'll start looking at it. The Dark Ages between S5 and S6 was, you know, similar, not so different. And so, so it's not going to be that long of a time period. There's still ongoing analyses. Kip and I just finished the search in S5. There's still S6 data. There's a lot of other data to analyze, a lot of other searches to do. We learned a lot about how what we need to improve, and there is a lot of work to be done. And a lot of us have a fairly clear perspective on what that work is, and basically our plan is to make sure that it gets done as soon as possible so that we're ready. So some of the things that we need to improve, because our events will be near threshold statistically, we really need to pin down our false alarm probability very rigorously. So we need to understand our detector characterization. We need to, just in general, do a better job of estimating our background. And I think we need to really explore what can be done with EM coincidence. This is something that's started already. In a lot of folks' minds, it's critical, actually, for the first detections. There are a couple of ways we can do EM coincidence. One is to trigger gravitational wave searches by using EM vents. That's been done for a while. The Andromeda GOB search was an example of that. The other is to actually use gravitational wave searches to trigger EM searches. The former is pretty easy. The latter is hard, especially if we need to do it quickly. So we need rapid analysis and localization. In S6, we actually had already formed quite a few collaborations with various optical and X-ray and radio telescopes, and we're actually sending events. So it was pretty nice to get that relationship started. And this is going to improve the number of agreements like this will increase, I think, dramatically in advanced LIGO. So just to give you an idea, we essentially in S6 had latencies that totaled around half an hour. So from the time of getting the data, taking the data, we were able to turn around in about 30 minutes to let a telescope know we're not something that's interesting there. If we need to do it quicker, it's definitely possible. I really think, and some of us in this room, in fact, are working quite hard towards a goal that's at least in order of magnitude improved. And we believe it should be possible. And so we're hoping that the advanced LIGO latency for turning around bends the telescope to that. Okay. Oh, yes, please.
So to reduce latency is really the main thing to do to get rid of that humans validate.
So the humans validate, sorry, I skipped over this a bit because we're running out of time. The humans validate thing, I think, is really more a better handle on false alarm probability. So the issue right now is
we still are in a stage where we sort of after the fact have to consider detector data quality and how it impacts that analysis. We still try to be as blind about it as possible, although when you start doing stuff like this, it becomes a lot more difficult to be blind, which is another concern. But understanding this, understanding from first principles, essentially, with the detector and the information we have, just how significant a candidate is, so that basically humans can be removed from the loop, is critical. And it's not, there's no reason why we can't do it. It's just going to take a lot of work. So that's it. So that's it. The point here is stay tuned. There will be many of us who are working tremendously over the next few years to make all of this possible. And I think we really need to be at the top of our game if we want to make the best use of the first few years of A-LIGO data. So if when we turn on in 2013, if we're talking about trying to make predictions by 2015 possible, it's going to require a lot of work and I think a lot of us are up to it. Thank you.
Interrupting you while you're speaking.
Yeah, I just have one comment. So Luis, you asked what are some of the, what happens when you have an LSC group? One of the things we can do as our own independent LSC group is admit members locally. You don't have to ask someone else permission. So if there are people here who are interested in helping out, you can now just join the collaboration by speaking to one of us. Okay, sorry.
And the one, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Sorry,
I was going to say that, the other thing that's important the one can do, even if they're not interested in getting in the thick of all of this data analysis, and that's understandable. Anyone interested in basically just coming up with tests, observational tests of other, interesting theories of gravity, would do that sort of thing as well. So. You don't have to commit to doing crazy stuff like, hard work. Sorry.
So I was just wondering, what's the main uncertainty in estimating these binary merge rates? And is there any way to pin down that?
So there are the number of samples, I think, actually. So we only have a handful of these double. There are just very few samples, and so the error bars are large. So having a better sense of just how many of these things exist will help pin down the rate. Also, what feeds into a lot of these rates are population synthesis models. But those are ultimately bootstrapped, I think, from observed things anyway. And so there's obviously a non-trivial correlation there. But I guess any improvement in those models could help.
But you think you're going to see it anyway? Doesn't matter.
I think when LIGO starts measuring things, we'll be the best one to answer the question what the rate is. And it won't take long before our estimate of the rate is better than anything else.
Okay.
Anything else?
In that case, let's thank all three speakers for this session again. And there should be coffee and goodies downstairs, and let's come back here at 4:15.
And I think there's also, they wanted to take a photograph when we go
yes,
downstairs.
Thank you.
So.
No.